forms and a relationship takes root. That kind of nurturing love, as opposed to the transactional way we often experience love, is absolutely a way to counter shame in the Black church. The healing that comes from it is also a kind of resistance against the narratives that try to diminish Black women elsewhere. God doesn't define us by our worst moments. God does hold us accountable for repeated bad moments. We can't use God's grace to justify oppression and injustice. We can't use the grace of God to excuse any violation of another's humanity. This is true whether we are talking about the unarmed Black man killed by police or the young woman pummeled by shame because the church doesn't take the time to nurture her heart. I often wonder who I would have been if I hadn't had the fire molested out of me as a child. If I'd felt that my voice and my questions would have been embraced in the churches of my childhood. If I'd been given tools for healing that extended beyond scripture memorization and silence. There's no way to know. What I am clear about is this. One day, when I'm old and gray, with whitish blue rings around my failing eyes, and I find myself belting out my favorite hymn, "Love lifting me, love lifting me. When nothing else could help, love lifted me." I won't have to only reach up for my peace, but I will be able to reach out into a faith community that values my mental, emotional, and physical safety over just my survival. Love absolutely will lift us, but there are generations of nanas, mamas, and baby girls looking for something else to help. The church has so much more than shame to give us.
Tracy Michelle Lewis Jiggetts is a writer, storyteller, and educator whose work explores the intersection of identity and faith and contemplative spirituality. Author of numerous books across several genres, Lewis Jiggetts is also the host of the podcast Heart Talk with Tracy Michelle.
Never Too Much, written and read by Mark Lamont Hill. I was about 5 years old when it happened. I don't recall who it was, but somebody in my family said something that hurt my feelings. I don't remember what they said, and I don't know if it was even particularly hurtful, but I do remember crying. I cried a lot when I was a boy. Too much, I was told. I was different, I was told. I was too sensitive, an observation that felt like both a judgment and a reprimand. Too sensitive. These were words that carried suspicion and wariness. Too sensitive. These words are among my earliest memories. They've haunted me ever since. As a young child, I was quiet. Like my mother, I was a reader. I didn't want to run around outside as much as my brothers, and I hadn't yet been bitten by the basketball bug that hit most of my neighborhood. Instead, I wanted to stay in the house or sit on the steps, losing myself in the books my mother brought home from work. These were not, I would learn, suitable choices for a Black boy, particularly one growing up in North Philadelphia. This isn't one of those gently anti-Black stories about anti-intellectualism or homophobia in my community. As Americans, we were as susceptible as anyone else to those elements, but not exceptionally so. We were human, not pathological. Something else was happening. I was loved, deeply. But we lived in a world framed by suffocating ideas about who a person, who a Black person, who a Black man needed to be in order to be safe and happy. This world held few safe spaces for little Black boys who moved through the world in the ways I was naturally inclined to move. So I learned to move differently. I learned not to cry. I learned that my humanity was bound up in my masculinity. I was taught that my masculinity was best shown through physical strength and paying bills and controlling space and being emotionally lean. And although we don't want to admit it, there was a functionality to this type of masculinity. As unhealthy as our performances were, looking tough and acting hard meant that people would be less likely to test us. Looking like we could fight meant that we wouldn't have to fight. And most of the time, deep down, we didn't want to fight. We just wanted to live. We just wanted to be loved well. We wanted to be seen. We wanted to be respected. We wanted to be human. My model for manhood came from my father. He held our family close and led us through storms, including the ones created by his own unhealthy masculinity. Although he was an educated man, he loved to work with his hands. He spent most of his free time fixing the broken-down rental properties that he owned. The repairs, the painting, the roofing, he did it all himself. I would run behind him on the way to whatever property he was fixing. He would call out from the front of the car, "Put that book down. Look at that building they're putting up over there." Part of that was, I'm sure, teaching me to be more social and observant. The other part, I think, was about balancing me out, pulling me away from the boy who sat on stoops and read Judy Blume while other children ran around. Like most men of his generation, my father showed little emotion and no vulnerability. And what other examples were there? Pop culture gave us The Cosby Show, but the Huxtable world of expensive art and famous friends was too foreign to seem real. And the other shows, Different Strokes, What's Happening, didn't have present Black fathers. Good Times gave us James Evans Sr., until he died in a car accident in Mississippi. But when he was present, James was the personification of traditional masculinity. He loved and provided for his family. He showed no vulnerability, no tears. James's emotional expression lived in two spheres: sensual desire for his wife and anger at some disruption or injustice. Lust and rage have always been hallmarks of American manhood. And they too are supported by a certain kind of logic. They make sense. They're reasonable. They're certainly not womanish, which is limited to crying or hysteria. Hysteria, by the way, comes from the Greek meaning womb, where life is formed. We have decried and diminished women for how they express their feelings, how they expose their vulnerability. At the same time, we yell and scream and punch walls, all while complaining that women are too emotional. We fail to see that our expressions of masculine rage are, in fact, emotions. And in our rage, we are never told that we are too sensitive or too emotional. As long as our only legible emotion is anger, we are never shamed. These are the rules that I learned and spent most of my early life following, religiously. Here's what I was not taught. Black men model manhood after those who oppress us. We measure our humanity against the humanity of those who seek to kill us, our family, and maybe most of the planet. We imagine freedom to be the ability to accumulate the kind of unchecked power and privilege of cisgender, heterosexual white men. We eagerly embrace the toxicities of this conception of manhood: hypermasculinity, hypersexuality, homophobia, misogyny, and violence. Anytime we deviate from this script, we feel less masculine. And when we feel less masculine, we feel less human. We swallow poison. We embrace preachers whose theologies subordinate women and dehumanize queer congregants. We venerate coaches who scream at us. We bond over fraternity rituals that require us to beat one another into brotherhood. We romanticize rage and the violence that accompanies it. Too often, our humanity is tied to our harm, our oppression. Like the invented category of whiteness, masculinity is an inherently corrupt idea. In the same way that I don't want to recover or recuperate whiteness or reform or rebuild the police, I don't want to recuperate masculinity. Instead, it must be destroyed, along with all other frameworks that prevent the full expression of joy, freedom, safety, self-determination, and dignity. And for Black men, the stakes couldn't be higher. It's June 2020, and America is on its heels. Not just because of COVID-19, but because young people have taken to the streets to resist state violence. I was asked to zoom into Drink Champs, a podcast hosted by rapper Nori, to discuss racism, policing, and other social issues. I was joining Nori along with rappers and activists Talib Kweli, Bun B, and My Song. About 2 hours into the panel, an unexpected guest popped in: Russell Simmons. I was stunned. Even before the accusations emerged about him, women friends that I knew and loved told me that he had sexually assaulted them. It had been a common story in the New York media world that I'd come up in. My blood boiled. Had I known that Russell was going to be invited, I would have immediately turned down or canceled the appearance. I texted Nori to express my frustration and tell him that I needed to leave. He wasn't checking his phone. Nervous, I texted a friend for advice. What do I do? She told me to stay, but be careful not to affirm Russell in any way. I did my best to avoid any contact with him or even acknowledge his existence. Although it felt like an eternity, Russell left almost as quickly as he'd appeared. After the show, the host apologized for not telling me about the surprise appearance. In the moment, I felt that I had done the best I could under unexpected circumstances. In reality, there were two options I didn't exercise: speaking out right then or immediately leaving the show. Instead, I allowed my desire to be professional to stop me from going off script or leaving without notifying the host. And this is the ultimate embodiment of male privilege. As a man, I had the luxury of not having to make better, more responsible choices because I am considerably less likely to be harmed in the same ways as his alleged victims. If a white supremacist had been on the show, I wouldn't have stayed. I would have voiced my opposition and swiftly removed myself. Did I worry that speaking out against a man who had harmed Black women would make me professionally vulnerable? Would I have to relinquish some false sense of manhood? What is the cost of silence in the face of sexual violence against members of our community, against women, against queer folk? At these moments, I realize that I have not come nearly as far as I would like to convince myself that I have. As an undergraduate at Temple University, I was taking an unreasonable number of courses. I was committed to graduating that fall, but I needed to find one more class that fit my schedule. After checking the offerings from the African American Studies Department, I found the perfect option, a course called The Black Woman. I didn't really have a sense of what it was about, but what did I have to lose? At the very least, I figured there would be a lot of Black women in the class. And I was right. I walked into a room of brilliant and beautiful Black women and only one other brother. The course was taught by Dr. Renoir McDonough, a Black feminist psychologist. We read scholarly texts like Critical Race Feminism and Black Feminist Thought, as well as novels like Their Eyes Were Watching God. The class radically shifted nearly everything that I thought I knew about myself, my sense of manhood. The work of bell hooks and Patricia Hill Collins helped me rethink my relationship to myself, my body, and the women in my life. For the first time, I learned to decenter myself and other male perspectives. I was unsettled in the best possible way. I realized that I was using my body in ways that weren't healthy for me. My choices weren't bringing me joy. In some ways, they were reinforcing my pain, the separation of mind and body. I was becoming emotionally void. I started reflecting on my relationships. I started to release the idea of healing through unhealthy means. Sometimes men start punching things because we want to cry. We smoke, we drink, we have a lot of sex because we can't locate any functional alternatives. Growing up, I had to find boy things to do in order to feel like I was a whole person. It started as basketball, and then as I got older, it was sex. I knew no other ways. What if there was something else? Possibilities began to unfold about not only a different world, but a different me in that world. Exploring these possibilities made me feel both better and worse. Who had I been and who could I be? I started to feel vulnerable. Instead of running from that feeling, I doubled down and started going to therapy. Today, therapy is a staple of my emotional diet, and I'm so much better for it. In the beginning, I saw it as a badge of shame, a sign of spiritual and psychological failure. Now it's a vital form of health maintenance. It's key to my survival. In order to unlearn unhealthy masculinity, we must run toward our fears. We must be willing to embrace the various forms of vulnerability that emerge when we disrupt the status quo. In my life, I've come face to face with the growing pains that accompany social, emotional, and professional vulnerability. Professional vulnerability asks, what jobs are you willing to lose? Social vulnerability asks, what networks and friendships are you willing to lose? Emotional vulnerability asks, which layers of masculinity am I willing to shed in order to be a better, or really a whole, person? As a progressive man and someone who identifies as a feminist, I have done my absolute best to unlearn the unhealthiest parts of my identity. Through therapy, through deep study, through engaged listening, I've unlearned the habit of restricting my emotions. At the same time, I have learned that I am allowed to be vulnerable, to be sad and in pain. I have come to think not individually, but collectively, in community. This meant that I had to be accountable to people as well as hold people accountable. Accountability requires that I resist unhealthy masculinity in real time as it takes up space. For example, in academic meetings where everyone has a doctoral degree, my female colleagues are disproportionately asked to take notes. My job is to disrupt that practice by pointing it out, as well as making sure that I or another male colleague takes the notes. Romantically, it's making sure that my partner isn't doing all the traditional domestic work. Socially, It's speaking out against homophobia, hypermasculinity, and patriarchy in moments when it's so much easier to just be silent. It's creating space for my gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer sibs. I had to acknowledge that there are other ways to perform gender and masculinity. I had to unlearn traditional gender roles. It's not enough for me to just not be homophobic. I cannot be friends with homophobes. I have to actually be willing to divest myself from relationships that are unhealthy. We all do. When we're hanging in the locker room and somebody says something homophobic, or when we're in the frat house and somebody says something misogynistic, we must be willing to speak up, even though there will be no social reward. And when the pushback comes, that's when we have to be willing to be strong. The people we're defending and the lives that we're affirming are more important than our social comfort. We have to be willing to detach ourselves from it. It's easy for me to proclaim these values publicly on a television broadcast or social media. I get all the benefits of being progressive when the world is watching. When no one is watching is when we're truly being tested. Emotional vulnerability can cut deep. The world hasn't created space for us, particularly Black men, to say, "What you said hurt my feelings," or "What you said made me feel insecure or inadequate. I miss you. I love you." These are things that we're not allowed to do. All of our emotionality has to come through the lens of those hyper-masculine traits like anger, violence, and sexuality. Sending a "what you doing" text at 2 a.m. and saying "I miss you" are two totally different things. Not believing that I had the space to be emotionally vulnerable is its own kind of pain. It kept me boxed in and prevented me from exercising the full range of who I am. It totally undermined my relationships. In my 20s, dating was very difficult. I wasn't able to express what I was feeling, so I remained silent or distant. I dated a woman who often said, "You're not a connector." I didn't know what she meant at the time, but I've realized that because I wasn't able to connect, it made it much harder for her to feel safe, happy, and loved in the relationship. My emotional rigidity made it hard for me to love her well. But when we're not emotionally vulnerable, we miss out on opportunities to have more authentic human relationships. It's harder to draw closer to our children. It's harder to draw closer to our parents. It's harder to draw closer to our romantic partners and friends. We never actually tap into the things that are bothering us or we're struggling with because we can't acknowledge that we're hurt. We convince ourselves that we're feeling something different. But it doesn't have to stay this way. We don't have to lose pieces of ourselves. We don't have to lose pieces of life. I often reflect on who I was as a little boy before I internalized the belief that my sensitivity and vulnerability were legitimate sources of shame. Back then, I instinctively knew to follow my joy and be present in my feelings. I knew to honor what I felt, and I knew that I felt a lot. I knew that I was never too much, that what I felt wasn't too much. I'm trying to know that again. I imagine a world where everyone has the kind of space they need to know their joy, a world where they can safely share their hearts, a world where their emotional needs can be met. And my freedom dreams are tied up with the project of dismantling any vision of manhood that limits or shames us. As long as we are not living in our full humanity, we cannot create a world for humanity. The key to achieving this world is found in the practice. Having good politics matters, but so does our collective and daily labor. If we want more Black men to be vulnerable, we have to continue to show them how. We have to normalize telling people we love them and showing the men in our lives affection. If we want to produce newer and healthier forms of masculinity, those of us with platforms, power, and access have to continue to model it. At 42, I'm watching a generation of people after me work to figure this all out. I want them to have corrected the mistakes my generation made and create new spaces for learning. It's happening. I'm beginning to see wider representations of masculinity, manhood, and emotionality. As for me, I'm still and forever in process. I continue to see so many contradictions in places where I fall short. I don't see myself as an exemplar. I'm just somebody who's trying his best to figure this world out, failing every day, but still committed to getting better. A few weeks before writing this, I was doing a podcast talking about the tragic death of Kobe Bryant, who I knew since childhood. In mid-sentence, as I reflected on the pain that came with the sudden loss, I started to cry. I couldn't have felt more vulnerable. But more important, I was completely okay sitting in that vulnerability. Despite my considerable failures and contradictions, moments like this remind me that I'm growing and learning. Decades after being told I was too sensitive, I've never been more emotionally expressive or transparent. I've never felt more available to the people I love. I've never felt more healthy. I've never felt more free.
Mark Lamont Hill is the Steve Charles Professor of Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University. He is the host of BET News and the author of multiple books, including We Still Here, Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility.
We are human too. On Blackness, Vulnerability, Disability, and the Work Ahead. By Kia Brown. In the spirit of honesty, I'm still figuring out what it means to be me. I know that I am a Black, disabled, queer woman, and with that comes the kind of beauty, pain, joy, and exhaustion to which words can't really do justice. But I try, anyway, because writing is one of the central ways I express myself. And self-expression is imperative to my survival. I am who I am, journalist, author, screenwriter, pop culture and fashion obsessive, cheesecake-loving, home goods swooning, romantic comedy aficionado, and I often find that writing about the things that make me me is how I make sense of the world and the people in it. I also write to make sense of, reckon with, explore, and decide who I want to be in that world. I am a Black woman with cerebral palsy. It affects the right side of my body. I walk with a limp and have delayed motor skills as well as a limited range of motion. I've not always been proud of my disability. For the majority of my life, as I'd navigate public space, I'd curl in on myself with every passing stranger's stare at my hand or leg. I never wanted to be the center of their attention, and the gawking always felt like being told that I was what they considered other. It also felt impossible for the gawkers to exist without making me feel bad as revenge for my disrupting their lives with my existence. I became ashamed of my appearance, of my limp, leg, and hand, too. But I have always loved being Black. In fact, the very first thing I ever learned to love about myself was my Black skin. As a kid, I'd watch Brandy as Cinderella, her beautiful blue gown the center of attention, the prince unable to help falling in love with her, and my mother as she would put on her makeup. I was in awe of the way we shared this beautiful skin, enamored with the idea that both a fictional woman and a real one could make me feel worthy, simply by having this one thing in common. There was a time when loving and sharing my Black skin with these beautiful Black women was enough to keep me going, but at 12, that stopped being so. As I turned my ear toward what my peers and society thought of disability, my own self-hatred began. A classmate made fun of me in the cafeteria, mocking the fact that I walked with a limp. For 12-year-old me, the discovery of my disability as a bad thing was earth-shattering, fueling a self-hatred with the shame of being different, undesirable, and invisible. Long gone would be the days when my Blackness alone nurtured my worth. The most interesting thing about shame is that it hangs around, like all bad habits do, thriving on its familiarity, allowed to remain because we are either too tired or too jaded to think we can survive without it. I carried the shame that popped up in that cafeteria with me to high school, throughout college, and well into adulthood. Along the way, I picked up the shame of being bad at numbers, of hating the way my voice sounded, of needing help, and of being what society told me was physically unattractive. I wished that God would spare me and I'd wake up the next day in a better body. From the ages of 12 to 25, Shame stole my ability to truly dream. I cared only about surviving and let shame convince me that no one genuinely cared about me. What I did not know is that shame would still be there after I learned to love myself and my body. For shame switches tactics. After overcoming the initial shame of my existence, I didn't really want to talk about how I'd felt ashamed of my body and of being me. When I wrote my book in 2019 about my journey to self-love, I wanted to project that I'd always possessed this self-assurance and self-acceptance. But I had to tell the truth. And afterward, as you might guess, I felt more shame for the person I'd once been. I'd gone from hating myself all those years to the embarrassment and regret of having ever felt that way in the first place, of having ever wanted a better, more digestible body. Thankfully, though, God intervened. And as my profile began to rise, and I had to talk more about what it took to get to the side of self-love, I had to learn to forgive myself. I'd gotten pretty far in life with the girl I once was, so I couldn't begrudge and shame her now. I can only hope she sees the woman we are today and rejoices. Now, at 29, I know shame will come and go, because the work we do on ourselves is a constant process. The most disrespected person in America is the Black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the Black woman. The most neglected person in America is the Black woman. Malcolm X said it in 1962, and unfortunately, it still holds true today. We are often forced inside boxes and stereotypes, stoic and strong, never showing the toll that motherhood, sisterhood, spousal support, education takes on us. Change has to come, and not because we long for Black women to save us, but because Black women deserve the chance to be who we are fully, magic, real, human, without apology or sacrifice. There are things that my body doesn't allow me to do, like walking long distances. This means I can't really attend physical protests. So I protest for change with the written word and across my platforms. I also fight by being all that I am without asking for permission. For instance, I like to say that there is a tear for every emotion, and I can find them all. Happiness, pain, anger. So I cry often, not in front of others, aside from my therapist, but in the quiet of my room when night falls. In February 2017, I cried tears of astonishment when the hashtag I created, #disabledandcute, went viral, global. I'd created it to help celebrate finally feeling good in my body. And to my delight, it is helping others do the same years later. Tears of relief, pride, fear, and anxiety came when my book was published. Leaving the set of the Today Show after a promotional segment, I hugged my literary agent, carefully avoiding getting his shirt wet. Last year, when I modeled in a virtual fashion show, aptly titled Fashion Revolution, during New York Fashion Week, I cried when I saw myself on my computer screen, strutting across my runway and giving the camera my best. When the show was over, I cried again, because no one can take that moment from me. I cried tears of joy once more after recording my TEDx talk, an event I thought would never actually happen. Like most of the world in 2020, I cried tears of fear and worry, of loneliness from missing my friends and loved ones, wanting them to be as safe and healthy as possible. I have always operated under the idea that to cry and be emotional as a Black woman is an act of resistance. I don't subscribe to the idea that I can't be emotional simply because our society has no idea what to do with the genuine feelings and humanness of women. I will feel, be, and do as much as I want proudly for the rest of my life. To be vulnerable and emotional as a Black woman is to live in power, which I take back every day, not apologizing for who I am or the space I take up as I move throughout the world. A reader once chastised me for using the phrase, "what I know now," in my book. Their reasoning was that a 27-year-old, at the time, could not possibly know enough to preach anything to her readers. As I write this, I think about that reader and how nice it is that they liked my book, but at the same time, I think it is ridiculous to think that talking about your lived experience is preaching. I don't have all of the answers, and I won't ever pretend to. But I believe that now more than ever, talking about our experiences is how we move forward. And honestly, I am tired of where we are. We deserve true, lasting change as a nation and the ability to exist in a world that sees people like me as full human beings. I believe in speaking things into existence. I have spoken my literary agent and my first two books into existence. I spoke my film and TV manager into my life, as well as two cover stories, a Today Show appearance, a first-class flight, meeting and becoming friends with my heroes, and modeling, among other things. I have never been shy about voicing my wants and dreams, of planning what the completion of them could bring about for my future. In those years when I stopped dreaming, I lost out on a lot, and so now I work hard to make up for it. Dreams and wants are nothing without hard work, and when you have the added barriers that Black women often have, it is imperative to take the time to relish your dream's completion before jumping on to the next. I know I struggle with sitting with my wins for a while, but I am working on that. I am resilient because I am ambitious. I am resilient because every time someone has told me I could not, I did. Apart from rollerblading and riding a bike, I have taken "you can't" and laughed in its face. When my twin sister and I were born 5 months premature, the doctors told my mother that we would never walk, talk, see, or go to a regular school. But we did. I want to be clear that none of those things is inherently bad, but they show that I have been underestimated since birth. I am the daughter of Cheryl Brown and the granddaughter of Vera Mae Brown, two of the most resilient Black women I know. We lost my grandmother in 2009, and 12 years later, I can still feel her guiding hand when things get tough. My resilience is due to the care and love from these two women, and from the Black women I am in community with and those who came before me. Growing up, I did not have the disabled representation I deserved, and so I tried to be that for the disabled Black girls and women who are coming up, so that they know anything is possible. Most of my resilience comes from my own determination to see a dream, a project, or a piece through. My life has been a series of lows and highs, of rejections and acceptances, of grief and loss, of great music taste and hope. This sounds like such a cliche, but I am excited for the future. I spent so long thinking that things had to be perfect before I could make a lasting change. But 2020 shook that right out of me. I cried on my birthday out of gratitude for making it 29 years on this earth. Through the wonder of technology, I survived and thrived, nurturing my relationships through and through during a pandemic. I raised my rates for writing and speaking, learning to value my time and expertise in a way that I was afraid to before. I said no to excessive free labor and yes to listening to my gut. I am still working on learning how to take breaks and days off, but we are all works in progress, right? I am still figuring out all of what it means to be me fully. This will be a lifelong process, I am certain. But I am up for the task. With every vulnerability, every ounce of resistance and shame, with love of the blackness, womanhood, queerness, and disability in me, I am going to continue to show up for my people and, most important, myself. And I am going to look cute doing it, because that is what I deserve.
Kia Brown is a journalist, author, and screenwriter. She has been published in The New York Times, Netflix Q, and Marie Claire UK, among other publications. She is represented by Alex Slater of Trident Media Group and Rachel Miller of Haven Entertainment. KiaBrown.com.
What's in a Name? By Lovey Ajayi Jones. My name is Lovey. Last name, Ajayi Jones. The Jones part is new. I got married in September 2019. I had many important decisions to make, like how many people's feelings I was going to hurt by not inviting them. Weddings are expensive, and I love more people than I can afford to love. Another significant decision I made was to take on the last name of the man I married. I took on the new but kept the old also because whoever said you can't have your cake and eat it too never sat in front of good cake. To drop the Ajayi part of who I am felt like I'd be leaving who I've been behind, which is strange because this is officially the fourth name I've gone by. You'd think I'd be used to changing up my name by now. I low-key understand Sean Puffy P. Diddy Diddy Love Combs. Low-key. Because sometimes you're compelled to go by something new as your life journey moves forward. Let me explain. First, I was Ifeoluwa Ajayi, then Lovette Ajayi, then Lovey Ajayi, now Lovey Ajayi Jones. The immigrant, the scared new girl, the growing adult, the married woman. I have made name switches in moments when I'm about to make leaps, often in fear, and often quickly, as if my spirit knows it's time. And each instance has led to me meeting who I was meant to be. My given first name is Ifeoluwa, and it means God's love. Ife, love. Oluwa, God. In Yoruba. Shortened, it's Ife. For the first 9 years of my life, that's what I went by. I am a child of Yoruba land. And in our culture, the names we are given lay the groundwork for a child who's entering the world. They are dreams for our future and are used to speak power into us and light our paths. My parents wanted my life to be anointed and led by love. So shall it be. I was born and raised in Nigeria, and my family moved to the United States when I was 9 years old. On my first day of school in Chicago, a city I had visited only once before, I felt strangeness for the first time. It was new for me to walk into a room where I'm expected to belong, yet not everyone looked like me. It was my first time being new, and it was the first time I felt like who I was just wouldn't do. Coming from Nigeria, where everyone looked like me and spoke like me and was black like me, the 9-year-old Ife was shook. Her usually solid feet wobbled a bit, and her self-assuredness hid behind her in fear. When I walked into the classroom, the teacher put me on the spot and asked me to stand in front of all these strange faces to introduce myself. I immediately felt my tongue was too heavy and knew I was too different. My name? I knew it wasn't welcome there. I just knew. because no one prepped me for this major change in my life and location. Ifeoluwa. Ifeoluwa. Oh, it would be a tongue twister. The tone was also specific, and it was too peculiar. It was too foreign, and it wouldn't do. So I introduced myself shakily as Lavette instead. It was a nickname that one of my aunts would call me from time to time. My given name felt like it was too much. What I felt wasn't shame, because I was truly proud of my name. I loved it. I felt the need to protect what was a sacred part of me. So I decided, in the 3 seconds after I was asked, that I wouldn't let people in school have access to that version of me. That is how Ifeoluwa Ajayi became Lavette Ajayi. Having teachers look at my first name on their roll call list, frown their faces, or say, "Whew, okay, this one is hard," when they saw it affirmed my decision. And then having them butcher Ajayi confirmed the message of, "This thing about you makes us uncomfortable." I began to show up early on the first day of every year so I could go to each class and teacher and correct them before everyone else showed up. I told them to cross out Ifeoluwa on the list and replace it with Lavette. I didn't even want to deal with the public butchering and shame projection sent my way. I settled into being Lavette quickly, as kids are adaptable. I chose her, and she was a necessary protector of my realm. At home, I was still Ife, eating her jollof rice and pounded yam with egusi stew. At school, sometimes I'd take sandwiches when I got tired of the kids saying, "What's that?" of my Nigerian food. By high school, I had lost most of my Nigerian accent and didn't stand out much anymore because of how I spoke. At graduation, we were required to be called by our legal names. Our school vice principal came to me a week before the ceremony and asked me to pronounce my name for him so he could get it right as I walked across the stage. He and I practiced my name for 10 minutes. Ooh, Lord bless it, but it was worth it. On graduation day, as I was next in line and handed over the card with Ifeoluwa Ajayi and its phonetic spelling written on it, my white vice principal saw my name, felt burdened by it, and said something that sounded like he was chewing gum. The only reason I knew he was referring to me was because there was no one in front of me. Come to fuck on, dude. We practiced. Ugh, just give me my diploma. This is why I'd revoked access to the use of that name. Then I got to college, where the best learnings are outside the classroom. It was there that I met others with stories like mine, who also went by new names to keep theirs from being butchered. It was there where people heard my last name, and instead of tilting their head in confusion, they beamed. "Oh, you're Nigerian! That's awesome!" In college is where people can be different in a way high school doesn't welcome. And to find that community was an affirmation and an encouragement to use my difference as a superpower. My first semester in undergrad, I took Chemistry 101. Because, like the cliche immigrant kid I was, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. But that dream came crashing down when I got a D. We thank God for some failures, because I don't even like hospitals. So I would have been, no doubt, the worst doctor ever. Anywho, I started a weblog that semester. I think it was called "Consider This the Letter I Never Sent." And it was emo as fuck and also terrible as fuck, because it was in Comic Sans, bless my heart. Still, I fell in love with writing and maintained an online journal throughout my undergrad years. I was Lavette to my friends still, but some started calling me Lovey for short. When I graduated, I deleted that blog where I talked about the exams I was failing and roommate beef and started a new one, Awesomely Lovey. I decided to talk about the world as I saw it. I talked about race, feminism, shenanigans, and anything else I felt like. I wrote with a voice that was without pretense, because I didn't think of it as anything but a hobby. I was working as a marketing coordinator for a nonprofit, and I liked it, but would get home and write on my blog regularly. It was like a part-time job that didn't pay me. Try as I might to insist that it was just a cute hobby that I had, my blog grew organically and started winning awards. More people started to know who Lovey was than who Lovette was. And people started to call me a writer. Me, she of no couth, who was only writing her opinions on a little website. Me, a writer? Isn't that what you call Toni Morrison and Terry McMillan? Those are writers. Yeah, so ain't no way I can be using the same title as them. That was imposter syndrome speaking, of course. That hater-ass bitch. I had convinced myself that my version of writing, therefore my gift, was not extraordinary. When I got laid off from my job in April 2010, I should have taken that as my cue to pay attention to this thing I was doing, but I still didn't give it credence. I looked for other jobs to no avail and would do freelance consulting to make money to buy shoes, cause priorities. There were times when I wanted to quit my blog because I figured that I should probably put more energy into job hunting than this little website. But every time I'd want to quit, I'd get some press or an amazing note from someone who'd read my work saying what an impact it had on them. In 2012, I got credentialed to do press coverage at the Academy Awards because of my blog. I got both red carpet and backstage access. I was in the room. I was eating all of Wolfgang Puck's catered shrimp back there instead of, you know, covering it when it finally made sense to me. I'm a writer. My words got me here. I was standing next to journalists from CNN, BBC, New York Times. I was out of excuses not to declare it. I'm a writer. Soon after, I was being interviewed by a journalist doing a feature on me in the not-so-little blog that could, and they asked, "How should we credit you for this? Lovette Ajayi or Awesomely Lovey?" I answered, "Lovey Ajayi," before I could even think too hard about it. "Just Lovey Ajayi is fine." I had all of a sudden dropped Lovette, and it didn't jar me at all. Why? Because I knew Lovey needed to move forward, and Lovette had served me well. It was time. The woman who can say, "I am a writer," with an exclamation point, not a question mark. The woman who was scared of what it all meant, but was excited to see about it anyway. The woman who knew her purpose was to move people with her words. She was here and ready to stand in it. That is how Lovey Ajayi came to be. I decided to keep doing that thing that scared me, because on the other side of it would always be victory. I went all in on my purpose-driven life, to use my words to make people laugh, think critically, and leave this world better than they found it. With that mission in mind, I wrote my first book, I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual, in 2015, and it was published in 2016. That book hit the New York Times bestseller list in the first week it came out. Changed my life. Because of it, I was able to fulfill my lifelong dream of retiring my mom. I called her a month after my book dropped and told her she never had to work again because I could officially handle her bills and mine. My life has changed so much since, and as my career has grown, my personal life has also shifted. I met a dude, started dating him, got proposed to, said yes, and got married to him. So on that day in September 2019, when I said, "Let's do this life thing together," in my wedding vows, it signaled a shift in my priorities. I've seen myself go from the work, work, work woman to the woman who is now trying to find ways to focus more on herself. Family is now first before anything. I felt compelled to reflect that in my name, which, for a recovering commitment phobe and a fiercely independent goat, is a big deal. I even put it in my first book that my taking my future husband's name was not a given, because what if his last name was something like Fokker? Thankfully, I found me a Jones. But was I going to take that name publicly and professionally? I wasn't sure. I was 34 when I got married, with a career that spanned 16 years. I had a brand, y'all. A brand. Was I going to change that? Well, my brand is of someone who is authentic. And the real me knew I wanted to do it, but I was scared. What was I scared of? Same thing I was afraid of when I didn't want to call myself a writer. The title of wife felt so big. And although I was one, I wasn't sure I could live up to it. Hell yeah, I was scared. So I did that thing I did with Lovette. I double-dutched between using Jones sometimes on professional things and leaving it off. For my speaking engagements or press mentions in the months following my wedding, there was no consistency. Sometimes I told people to use Lovey Ajayi. Other times I said Lovey Ajayi Jones. It got confusing to me in a way that was familiar, and I knew I had to make a decision. One day, my literary agent, Kristen, called and asked, "What name should we put on your book cover?" regarding my second book, Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual. I told her I'd call her back. Then I called two of my friends and asked them what they thought. They didn't give me the answer I wanted, which was firm direction. They simply said, "Well, what feels right for your book?" Me, "I don't know. That's why I'm calling you. Tell me." Nope. They did no such thing. Wow. So I really have to figure this out on my own, huh? Adulting is a scam. I called Kristen, told her to show me two versions of the cover. One that said Lovey Ajayi, one that said Lovey Ajayi Jones. So she did. And the only one that felt right was the one that said Lovey Ajayi Jones. Why? Because the other one felt incomplete, as if it was missing something. It was missing the new version of me that I needed to own, fully, not halfway. I couldn't half-ass this, even though it was scary. I called Kristen and said, "Lovey Ajayi Jones." I went on all my websites and changed my display name. I didn't do it to prove anything to anyone, not even myself. I did it because everything in me said, do it. It was scary and daunting and a loud proclamation of who I now was and one of the things I prioritized, the sacred space of my marital home. It wasn't that I'd be less married if I decided to go by Lovey Ajayi. The decision of what name we choose once married does not invalidate our commitment. But for me, like in the past, I knew that to be all in for this new season of my life, this was important for me to do. I couldn't drop Ajayi, though. Across the years, as my name has shifted, that has remained steady. That has anchored me. I needed it to remain, to continue to tie me to my culture and lineage publicly, even as I created my own traditions. I also think about a little 9-year-old girl somewhere who is in a new land, whose name is also heavy on people's tongues. I want her to have me to look to as an example and an affirmation that her roots are worth keeping strong. I hope she hears my Ajayi spoken and knows her diasporic epithet is worth celebrating, not hiding. Besides, Lovey Jones sounds very much like I'm trying to be nostalgic about a 90s romantic movie fave, Love Jones. Although, it was the reason we made our wedding hashtag Love Jones. That's L-U-V-V Jones. Best wedding hashtag of all time, in my not humble opinion. I've settled into the woman I am and into this marriage thing. My 3-pronged name feels like a pair of shoes that are slightly too big because I still have much growing to do. An expansion can be daunting, but often it is necessary. I don't plan on making another name change. Mr. Jones is stuck with me forever, and he is very welcome. Ifeoluwa Ajayi made way for Lovette Ajayi to protect herself in a new land. Lovette made way for Lovey to claim her purpose. Lovey Ajayi Jones has taken all the lessons she's learned from all of them, and is the best version of herself she's ever been, wiser than ever and more grown than ever. My names, all 4 of them, have been teachers for me, and I'm thankful for each of those people I was, because they led to who I am today. And I'm thankful to my parents for naming me so well. The path of love they lit for me in my name has been a tool of resilience through any fear and an anchor through chaos. The names we have tell stories, and mine speak of the journey of someone who has transformed so many times in her life, taken ownership of who she is in the world, and creating sacred spaces for herself. My names have been my affirmation, and I'm grateful.
Lovie Ajayi Jones is a New York Times best-selling author, speaker, and podcast host. Her new book, Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual, drops March 2nd, 2021.
The Blues of Vulnerability. Love and Healing Black Youth. By Sean Egg Ginwright. Read by Myron Willis. Uncle Kenny didn't just listen to the blues. He savored every delicious, corn-battered, deep-fried lyrical nugget, the kind only Muddy Waters, Etta James, and B.B. King could serve. His cigarette would dangle from his lips as he flipped through his blues albums in the living room. I was only 10 years old the first time I heard Bobby Blue Bland bellow out in his gritty, golden voice, "They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad." Uncle Kenny was tall and dark, with beautiful bluish black skin. "The blues is about life, the good and the bad," he'd say to me. I learned to listen, appreciating the deeply honest, soulful, vulnerable pulse of the blues. The blues is about the soul opening up and pouring out whatever is inside, without shame, blame, or polish. Done well, it is raw, gut-bucket truth-telling. But to get there requires a depth of emotional risk-taking and big doses of courage. The artist has to dive headfirst into some murky emotional waters with real honesty about the trouble that's been rattling around deep inside, and then put it on display for all to see. That's why we don't really listen to the blues. We feel them magically connecting to parts of ourselves we are afraid of, reminding us that we are human and struggling desperately, trying our best to be better. The truth is, there is power in our vulnerability, and our capacity to share parts of ourselves, even the parts we hide from, gives us enormous strength. Black young people in America know the blues all too well. They feel the blues in schools that feel like prisons. They taste the blues each time a police officer stops them on the street. They can hear the blues every time they are turned away from a job. Black young people disproportionately experience higher rates of violence, poverty, and trauma than other racial groups. These traumatic experiences inflict a psychic wound that shows up as depression, despair, hopelessness, fear, anger, and pain. Vulnerability can be one of the most important pathways to well-being among young people. When we lean into our own vulnerability with young people, it gives them permission to do the same. Just like the blues, vulnerability is emotional risk-taking, putting it all on the table and trusting that you won't be hurt when you do. Vulnerability is also the only way to form true transformative relationships because it raises the emotional stakes and creates a sacred agreement that what you just shared will be held and protected with tender care without judgment. I've worked with young people for nearly 30 years. My years of working with African-American youth have taught me that we all have to play the blues every now and then. Emotional deception has no place in transformational work with young people of color. Those of us who work with youth know that the relationship is the most important intervention. That's why we have learned to keep it real, and sometimes that means being vulnerable and letting our humanity spill out. When we do that, we make a sacred agreement, weaving together trust and honesty, a brilliant fabric of authentic care, which is, of course, precisely what young people need in a world that shows them no love. How might we lean into vulnerability in ways that heal and restore young people's sense of belonging and well-being? Living the Blues: Trauma and Vulnerability. In 1989, I founded a summer camp for African-American teens to restore their sense of well-being from living in highly stressful and violent neighborhoods and schools, a sanctuary for healing and soul restoration, and a refuge for the practice of vulnerability. Since that time, I've worked with more than 10,000 teens, and I've learned a great deal about the power of vulnerability as an antidote to the trauma they've experienced. When a few college friends and I started the camp, we had no clue that so many young people were yearning for a space to laugh, play, cry, and heal. The depth and level of trauma young people were dealing with overwhelmed me, and I wasn't prepared to describe what was happening to our youth. For example, I taught a session one summer about trauma and toxic stress and their impact on one's well-being to a small group of young people from Oakland. I explained to them, as I had been trained, the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder and what symptoms might look like. One young woman in the group calmly raised her hand and replied, "Ain't nothing post about stress where I live. Something is always popping off." She was correct. The term PTSD was inadequate to capture the depth, scope, and frequency of trauma in her environment. For her and many young people of color, stress is persistent, not post. What she described was that trauma and crisis were commonplace in her neighborhood, and as a result, she and many of her peers had learned to work and live in persistent traumatic stress environments. Let me say that again. Persistent traumatic stress environments. There is an important distinction here. PTSD highlights the root causes of trauma, like food insecurity and lack of housing and access to medical care, while PTSD diagnoses only a disorder resulting from a past experience that is presumed to have concluded. African-American youth often experience greater stress, anxiety, and depression because of the lack of safety, economic opportunities, and basic housing that are fundamental to well-being. Researchers, practitioners, and policy stakeholders all confirm that persistent stress has a negative impact on learning, healthy behavior, and mental health. But young people don't describe what they see and experience every day like that. They just know that something is always popping off. Yet the ongoing exposure to persistent trauma is devastating. I learned that firsthand working with Greg, a soft-spoken 17-year-old whose wide smile showed off his gold teeth. Greg's close friend was shot and killed not far from his home in East Oakland. Greg was there when it happened. When I asked him privately, "How are you feeling?" he responded precisely as almost every young man of color has when faced with a similar line of inquiry. "I'm cool. I'm good. I'm all right." The most egregious consequence of living in a persistent traumatic stress environment is the inability to feel. We know from research that emotional numbing is a coping mechanism to avoid processing the emotional turmoil. It's like hiding from your emotional self, stuffing all that emotion into a box and tucking it neatly away down the basement. When many African-American youth experience trauma, they don't really have a way to get all the emotional stuff out of the basement. This is made even worse when young people lack the emotional vocabulary to name what's happening. I've never had a young person say to me, "I'm scared and frightened about what happened," or "I felt rejected and unloved when my father left me." So all that persistent traumatic stress stays inside, getting pushed further and further down. The only real way to get all that emotional stuff out is to create an environment of safety and trust where young people can express what's on their minds and hearts. As Brené says, people have to earn the right to hear your story. And the only way to really connect with young people is through your own vulnerability, honesty, and rooted realness. It's sort of like playing the blues. You have to dig down deep, pull out things that you've been hiding, and put them on display. Playing the blues. Healing-centered engagement. Healing-centered engagement is akin to the South African term Ubuntu, meaning that humanness is found through our interdependence, collective engagement, and service to others. The healing-centered approach comes from the idea that young people are not harmed in a vacuum, and therefore their healing cannot happen in one. Healing comes from sharing our stories and holding space to hear one another's pain and joy without judgment. We know from research that healing is experienced collectively, and shaped by shared identity, such as race, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Healing-centered engagement is the result of building a healthy identity and a sense of belonging. For youth of color, these forms of healing can be rooted in culture and serve as an anchor to connect young people to a shared racial and ethnic identity that is both historically grounded and contemporarily relevant. I found that healing circles are an important feature in creating the space for communal healing. These circles create sacred bonds between people that are never broken, because when we are vulnerable in this way, we can truly see one another. Similar to a disaster, like a plane crash, or a natural tragedy, like Hurricane Katrina. These events bring people together in profound ways because our fragile exteriors are stripped away to reveal our raw humanity. Healing-centered engagement embraces a holistic view of well-being that includes spiritual domains of health. This goes beyond viewing healing only from the lens of mental health and incorporates culturally grounded rituals and activities to restore well-being. When we sit together in a circle, we find commonality through our collective sharing. What makes this process?